Welcome to Jaipur Bites. I'm your host, Lakshdatta. We're live from day 4 of the Z Jaipur Literature Festival, and the session you're about to listen to is called Adaptations. Andre Akumen, Chitra Banerjee Divakaruni, Irvine Welch, and Jan Martel
being here. It's wonderful being here. I did it, as Katriona mentioned, Vikram is sick. He said it's probably, he caught a bug coming from San Francisco to India. And he says probably the first time India has not been responsible for his stomach problems. So it's kind of a different change for him. But we wish him well. We hope he's going to get well soon. This is a wonderful panel because it brings together two things we all love, books and movies. So before we start, I thought I'd take a quick poll. You know, so four writers here, there's several movies between them in terms of their books. But I want a quick show of hands as to how many of you have seen at least three of the films from these four. Well, we'll name the. Why don't you each name the films that have been made of your books? They want it. It's on.
Call Me by Your Name.
Mine, I have different kinds of movies. Mistress of Spices for the big screen. Sister of My Heart as a Tamil TV serial. Short film, art film, Amar Ma. And now Palace of Illusions and Forest of Enchantments are both going to be made into movies.
Essentially just Life of Pi. One of my short stories was adapted to Canadian television. But essentially just Life of Pi.
Train Spotting as first one, and then it was The Acid House, Filth, Ecstasy, and Porno adapted as Train Spotting 2, and currently two TV adaptations in the works.
All right, so now you know the films. Okay, at least three of those. How many people have seen that? Pretty good. How many people have read at least three of those books?
Hey, more. That's better.
See? That's why we're at a literature festival. Come on. Great. So I thought I'd start by asking each of you very briefly to tell me a bit about the first time that you saw the film version of your book. What went through your head? Very briefly.
You asking me?
All of you. So starting with you, Andre?
Well, the first time I should have seen it, I refused go because it was too cold. Yeah, I just didn't want to do it. But the time that I did finally see it, which was at Berlin, I went in feeling that I didn't belong. And I walked in and I saw the actors and everybody's very famous. And then I saw the film and I said, I thought I knew this story, but this, and I didn't know where it was going to end. So I just was surprised by the ending, and I thought it was terrific. Oh, this is a moment in which the character stares at the camera or at the fireplace, and that's nice. And then I saw the credits come down, and then my heart broke because I said, oh, my God, this is more sad than I thought it could be.
Well, the first time I saw Mistress of Spices, this was at the Toronto Film Festival, and, of course, I was very excited. Gurinder Chadha, the co-director, was there, and you know, the film credits came up and it said based on the novel by Chitra Banerjee Divakaruni, and I kind of went into this fugue state, and then by the time I came out of it, the credits were rolling. No. I thought it was wonderful in a very different way from the book. So I was like, wow, but is this my book? That was my feeling.
we'll get into a little bit about the differences. Yeah?
First time I saw Life of Pi was in New York. The studio flew me into New York. And I saw it all by myself in an enormous cinema in New York with one person next to me. And that was Suraj Sharma, who plays Pi. And so it was kind of weird being in this enormous cinema all by ourselves. And also, Suraj had never seen it. So he had obviously played in it, but he'd never seen the finished product. He'd been in the artificially held up lifeboat with an actor pretending to be a... He'd all seen the artificiality. He never saw the whole thing. So it blew his mind. He just could not believe what the end product was. So I was, he was like, not in hysterics, but he was like, could not believe it. And I was sort of... So it was an odd experience. You recognize your book, but it's obviously something else. And Life of Pi, as some of you might know, is a first-person narrative. So you never see Pi in a movie necessarily. The camera's looking at him the whole time. So the change of perspective, kind of odd. I thought it was kind of odd and colorful and noisy and didn't rock my world particularly.
All right.
Well, obviously, probably talk about Trainspotting. There was a screening of it in the Soho Hotel in London, West London, and I went down to the... I was very nervous about it because I really liked the people that were doing it, and I wanted it to be successful. So I thought I wanted also to get the most critical audience that I could in London. And so I went down to the Fortress Studios in East London. And I got a lot of the people from the bands, all the Britpop bands at the time used to rehearse in the Fortress Studios. And my friend Fatty had the Bar and Grill that was the sort of the place they all hung out. So I kind of just basically brought them all round. You know, it was like a lot of them had tracks on the soundtrack. So I said to Danny, can I get a few more spaces? He said, who the fuck are you bringing round here? You know? I said, well, you don't want to know, really. So he was quite nervous about that, I think. So they all came round, and they were very... We'd had a few drinks, and they all loved the book, so they were very hostile. They were very, very kind of looking to be hypercritical. And I was kind of... I remember I was sitting beside, you know, with Bobby Gillespie and Andrew Innes from Primal Scream on opposite sides of me. I was just watching the screen, then I was watching them. And they started, they looked very hostile at first, and they started to thaw, and then they started laughing, and they got into it, you know, heard, that's never Begbie. You know, and then it was like, you know, yeah, this is great, you know. So they got into it, and they were very, very kind of excited and animated at the end of it. And everybody got very drunk and had a great time.
There we go. Before I go on, just as an aside, I read somewhere that... Trainspotting is apparently the most shoplifted novel in British history. Is that true?
And that's by me personally. I was very prolific. My thieving was very prolific back in these days. I've slowed down a bit now, but keep an eye on me in that bookstore.
I want to pick up on something that actually you mentioned in your session yesterday, Andre, when you were talking about the film and you said that now it sometimes feels harder, that you can't think of what your characters, Elio and Oliver, actually looked like in your head because now you see the actors playing that. Is that a good thing for a writer?
Well, I don't think it doesn't matter. You know, because you have something. And by the way, when you're writing a novel, you have an image of the character, but that image changes constantly.
Over the course of it.
Yeah, as you're writing... I mean, I had, Elio was at some point blonde, then he was dark-skinned, then he was white-skinned, and it just morphed all along. Well, he doesn't look at himself, so he makes references to his body. So, and those change all the, and I'm always worried that editors will catch you and say, that's inconsistent. Okay,
he was blonde in chapter two, and now suddenly his dark hair has fallen on the pillow.
I changed my mind, I'm sorry, okay? But, basically, it gets imprinted in your mind, and so some of the events that are no longer in the movie, I remember them less than I did before, because they're no longer sort of images. They just become just words, and then the words disappear, and I'm no longer focused on them.
I wonder if that's true for all of you, because Ian, you mentioned in your comments that when you were writing Life of Pi, you were looking out through Pi, and there's actually no description of Pi himself in your book. So when you suddenly see Suraj Sharma on screen, I mean, you said it's a different perspective, but just that perspective shift, did that really feel very, was that unsettling in any way?
I find the movie was unsettling in many ways, because there's that, first of all, the change of point of view. But also the language of cinema is radically different from the language of words. For example, in Life of Pi, there's the sinking of a ship. Now, words are very good at describing emotions and thoughts. You can exceptionally well describe those two with words. But words are not particularly good at describing visuals, especially alien visuals. A little widget that someone doesn't know what it's like to describe with words is a lot of work. So when it came in Life of Pi to describe the shipwreck, I thought to myself, why am I going to bother describing this? Everyone knows vaguely what a shipwreck possibly looks like. So I use those immortal words in Life of Pi. I said, the ship sank, period. And then I kind of move on, because of greater interest to me was how Pi felt about it. Well, in cinema, the ship sank is amazing. It's a very charismatic visual event. So what was three words in the book became several minutes in the movie. And conversely, what I spend a lot of time in the book talking about, thoughts and emotions to do with religion or reality or whatever, well, those can't be visualized, so they kind of vanished. So it was an odd translation. Mm-hmm. So that's what was more jarring, is seeing things visualized that were in my head were fairly minor, not quite inconsequential, but not terribly important. And then other things that were very consequential sort of vanish in the whole. So to me, the best, and I think this is probably shared by all of us, the best process is to read the book first and then see the movie. And then you can sort of fill in the holes that are in the visual narrative.
But what about, for example, dialogue? When you're writing the dialogue, but when, say, an Irfan Khan in the film is talking and you hear the Indian accent in it, does it add something? Like, in your head, when you were writing, were you hearing an Indian accent, as it were?
Well, that's another thing. In my experience, and it's very different from Irvine's and the other, is dialogue in a book is very different from real dialogue. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, we rarely speak in complete sentences, and even more rarely in entire paragraphs. We're inevitably interrupted, or we lose track of what we're thinking.
Or we say, you know.
Exactly, we say, you know, exactly. So the dialogue, you know, it's like in Jane Austen. We presume, I'm convinced no one spoke like the dialogues of, like we speak in Jane Austen. We presume they do because they lived 200 years ago, but I bet you they didn't. They're just like us, as incoherent. So I find the dialogue from the book that appears literally in the movie isn't good because we don't speak like that. It's not as natural. So I think they're quite separate, and the translation has to be very able. And I found the translation of Life of Pi, the weakest part of Life of Pi was the screenplay to me. The visuals were gorgeous and all that, but the translation of the actual adaptation, I thought was a bit narratively limp, whereas the visuals were gorgeous.
Chitra, in terms of what Andre just said, now when you think of Tilio from Mistress of Spices, does Aishwarya Rai's face float up first?
Well, you know, when Gurinder and I were discussing possible people to play the Mistress of Spices, I pointed out that the Mistress of Spices in the book is actually an old woman for three quarters of the movie. And Gurinder kind of looked at me and she nodded her head. And the next I heard is Aishwarya was playing that role. So my experience has been that face-to-face, everyone has always agreed with everything I've suggested. And when the movie comes out, it's a whole different beast.
I mean, people who were really fans of the book were actually kind of, they were like, oh, she's just so too beautiful, too glamorous, which is the world of movies, I guess.
Yes, yes. And on the other hand, I have to say many people came to me and they said, we just loved the movie and then we read the book.
And she's really old in the book.
Why is she so old in the book?
And in the same way, you have, Trainspotting, and then there has been a sequel. You've written four books that deal with the characters first made famous by Trainspotting. So now when you're writing about Renton and all these characters, is Ewan McGregor's face in your head?
Yeah, the actors tend to take over, not just the screen ones, but also if you've been to a stage version, you know, you have the actor's face when you go to write. So the horrible thing is you have to go back and read these old books again, you know, to get your image of it, of that character as it was. And that's a terrible thing to do. You have to read one of your own old books. It's horrible.
It's like homework.
You never want to see those things again once you've got rid of them. But yeah, I think it's interesting what you were saying there about the. I think the book is always better than the movie because everybody who reads the book is making a movie in their own head as they're reading it, and their movie is always going to be better than anybody else's. You know, you've got. So I think that's the kind of strength of the book, really. It's kind of quite, you know, as somebody who loves books, you know, I love films and TV as well, but it's kind of quite depressing that now so many books are obviously kind of written not as books in themselves, but as as TV kind of future TV movies or future TV shows. And I must say that I'm kind of guilty in some ways of thinking in that way myself now. You know, I feel that there's always a kind of reaching beyond what's there. And I don't think it's been particularly good for my writing personally.
Mm. Well, you know, it's funny. I was reading that Danny Boyle, who directed the film, you know, he wanted the same characters to age and play their different versions in the sequels. But Danny Boyle complained that actors are so vain, they don't age fast enough. So you really have to wait a longer time for them to catch up with the age in the films. But in terms of, you know, what you...
High-definition cameras being a godsend as far as that goes. Like, you can get into all these little nooks and crannies and sort of marks and stuff.
But now when... we look at the, you know, when you mentioned that the book is always kind of better than the movie because there's a movie in your head. Now I'm going to ask you something that might feel a little rude. A book and a film are not necessarily in competition with each other. Often in these things that they're kind of set up. And of course, as the writer, you want the movie to succeed and do well. But as the writer, is there a little deep secret sneaking part in you which also wants people to always say, but the book was so much better? Who wants to take that?
I can think of a couple cases where I felt the movie was better than the book. But you're right, it's very rare. One of them was Fahrenheit 451. The original short story by Ray Bradbury. It's definitely good, but he has other things happening in it. And François Truffaut went to the heart of it and got the key element, the burning of the books, really well. And the other one that I thought the movie was better was Blade Runner. Blade Runner is based on a novel by Philip K. Dick called Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? And once again, he had many things happening that were sort of distractions, and the movie went to the core of it, the idea of identity and robots and humans. So that, but most cases I agree that books are better. And it's also because a movie is always kind of like a kidnapping. It tells you what to see, very obviously. It's visual. But also the music is very manipulative. The music in cinema always tells you, in case you're autistic, it tells you this is how you should feel. And as much as that's a powerful experience, and we sometimes like being overwhelmed, it's also like a kidnapping. And I think we value our freedom. And as Irvine was saying, when you read a book, you create that story in your head. You co-create it. You give it the visuals, the face of the characters. You imagine how the things are. Because you're co-creating it, you feel more involved, and therefore it's more gratifying, a creative experience. I think it's because of that. I think the nature of language is very empowering, and the nature of visuals is overpowering.
Anybody else wants to add something?
Well, I wanted to say that I love watching movies. So, you know, I'm very happy when my books are made into movies. Now, I've come to a conclusion, although with Palace of Illusions, I'm trying to take a much more active role in in the screenplay and who will play which part. But I know that ultimately those decisions...
Because they'll nod their head and say, ha, and then you'll find whoever.
Yes, and actually really the producers who want to make money out of that film will make a lot of those decisions. And so I don't expect the movie to be like the book, but I hope that it will keep the feel of the book. That's if it does that, if people say, yes, it felt the same to me, I'd be happy with that.
Well, I'm going to take the opposite side.
Please do.
Because somebody has
to.
I always tell people, and they always tell me, they tell me that they have read the book first, and that's as it should be. And I say the very opposite. You should see the film first, and then you see the movie, you read the book. For a very simple reason, that when you read a book and you see a film afterwards, you feel that you still remember all those scenes that are lost in the film, because they had to be lost. And then you feel cheated. Even if the film is terrific, you feel cheated. What happened to this character? Oh, this character was totally eliminated. Whereas if you see the film first and then you read the book, you have a kind of plot outline in your head. And then you see, but God, there's so much more in the book than there ever could have been in a film. And that's wonderful.
So when you... I'll get to the sex question straight away. When you... When Call Me By Your Name was made, did you think that there would be... When, were you bummed that there was less male frontal... I shouldn't have said bum when I was talking about male frontal nudity. But anyway, were you a little disappointed that there was less male frontal nudity in the film? Because James Ivory, in an interview, said, you know, it's kind of phony that people have sex and then they suddenly wander around wrapped in a bedsheet. Well, which is what you can do in a book. In a movie, it becomes dicier because people have contracts with, say, no frontal nudity and all of
right,
that.
Right, right. Well, I mean, the typical joke is whenever you have a couple, a man and a woman in bed, and at some point, after they've had sex, the man, you can see his tummy because he's covered in the sheet. But the woman is always covering her top. And you will say, why is she always covered? Oh, because I have a dirty mind and I want to see the rest. But the real issue is that you feel sometimes that the sex, to be honest with you, I describe seeing the sex act frontally and not obliquely enough. Overpowering and sometimes something I don't want to look at. It's very much for me the same thing as when you see a drug addict injecting a needle. Yeah, that's your zone, okay. I don't like to see a doctor, okay, injecting someone with a needle and you see the needle entering his skin and that little sort of drop of blood coming out. I don't want to see that. And I feel the same way about any kind of sex, man, woman, woman. There's a scene...
Man peach.
No, that's special.
That you need to see.
No, but I just don't like to see it. So I didn't mind the fact that it was overlooked. But there is a moment in the book, and I was... In the book, you have very, very specific and very overt sex. But you have a moment in the film when they are playing with their feet. And at some point, I think that Oliver says to Elio, what are you doing? Because he's playing with a female, nothing. And that, for me, was as good as any act of foreplay that you would ever see. And then you see a tree, okay? And you know exactly what's going on. You need to see it. No.
We've seen a lot of Bollywood films. You do that, and then you go to the tree or the flowers.
Yeah, I think that, again, it's a different language of cinema. And cinema is much more of a collaborative art form than the novel. I mean... I remember I was adapting one of my own books for a screenplay, The Sex Lives of Siamese Twins. And there's a kind of, maybe about a four page, in the book, the novel is about a four page kind of lesbian sex scene, which I kind of enjoyed writing, I must confess. I was adapting this and I thought, my God, you know, I can't ask kind of people, actors, to do this on screen because it became kind of real in a way. So this four-page kind of sex scene was just condensed to they make love. Let the director sort that one out. That's what they're getting paid for.
But you know, you're talking. You brought up the process of write. You know, when you're writing, you can write anything. When you make films, it's different. So for each of you, I wanted to ask you, because writing is also such much more solitary activity. You're in your head. And then the filmmaking is such a huge collaborative activity. So many people are involved. Did you ever visit the set? And then what did that feel like? To see somebody taking something that was actually just in your head, and then now this huge team of people are trying to bring it to life. Who visited the set? Did you visit the set yet?
Yeah, I did. Life of Pi was filmed mostly in Taiwan, because Ang Lee was Taiwanese. He's a superstar there, so they helped him enormously in ways that is uncredited financially in the movie. They gave him this enormous airport to use for free. So a lot of it was filmed there, and key scenes were filmed in India. One of the rare times when American cinema actually bothered itself to come to India and film your beautiful country. But the last 2 days of the shoot were in Montreal, and they invited me to see that. Otherwise, Ang Lee didn't want me around. He was afraid that I'd be sort of picking away at his vision, which I told him I wouldn't, but anyway. And it was surprising, as you said, words are so easy. They're so easy to catch and put on the page, whereas the construction of reality in cinema is so cumbersome and artificial. So I remember it was astonishing. In the last 2 days of the shoot, half of that, one of those days, was filmed just static images of food. And, you know, you're right, there's 50 people around to just shoot a plate of food. It was, and also, the other thing that surprised me with cinema is that, I don't know what my fellow writers write, but I'm not going to write 3,000 pages to then boil it down to 300 pages. That's too much work. I try to write as little as I can possibly to get it right. Where cinema, I thought it'd be the same thing, because cinema is so expensive to make. I thought they'd try to get it right quickly, which is why they storyboard. Well, in my experience with Life of Pi, not at all. Once they got the green light, once Hollywood, the producers, gave it the green light, they give their artists license to create, and it's unbelievably wasteful. They film so many hours that are finally cut away, because I guess the fear is this won't please audiences, so we have to change it. Maybe they won't like the tiger, so let's, you know, have it Life of Pi with a camel, maybe. They just do all these crazy things that are wasted, but every time they do it, it's unbelievably expensive. So Life of Pi had an unusually long shoot. It took 102 days. Your average movie will be about 60 days of shooting. And every minute of those days is planned, but then shit happens. And they have to do extra filming, extra this, redo that. So that's why they're always, in my experience, they're just below a level of absolute hysteria. Because they're so stressed about the money they're spending. But it's also incredibly creative, but unbelievably wasteful. So that's the thing that struck me about how they shot it. I sort of forgot what your question was. So
that was the question. But do any of you have anything to add from watching a whole group of people suddenly being responsible for something only you were responsible for?
Well, you know, because of that, the slow nature of filming, much of Mistress of Spices was filmed in Canada, and then some of it was filmed on location in the United States, in San Francisco. So the dates got pushed back and back and back. So when they were actually filming in San Francisco, I was already in India with my new book. So I couldn't be there.
I was actually there when they were filming.
You were there.
I was in a background scene and they cut me out. But anyway, I'm not holding that.
Murthy, my husband Murthy was there, and my sons were there, and they were extremely bored because the same scene would be filmed over and over and over.
Because it was the same extra who kept walking back and forth.
But what I really liked was going with Gurinder Chadha and her husband Paul Burgess to choose the locations that they would film, because they said, you know the Bay Area, why don't you come with us, show us where you imagine these things happening. So I felt like I had some real input into location, and I was very happy with the location filming.
Yeah, did you have a cameo in Life of Pi?
Yeah, I did. Those who've seen the movie, there's a scene where the adult Pi and the author are speaking on a bench, and the camera's behind the bench, and there's a little pond, and there's someone on a bench on the other side. C'est moi. I was there. Ang Lee came four times over to direct. It must have been the most directed extra. But so, yeah, I'm there. But you have to know that I'm there. But anyway, that's me there.
So I have to tell my experience, which is I was already in India, but they wanted me there. So they chose a magazine where I was on the cover, and they artfully displayed that magazine at a certain moment.
I thought they would Photoshop you into the scene. Did you want to add something, Andre?
Well, I went to the set. In fact, they invited me to come to the set. And I may have said this already, but I arrived in Milan, and I was going to go to a hotel and sleep. And they said, no, the director demands that you come right on scene, and he wants to know your size. And I said, "What? No, not what no, part no. of it. Sorry, I shouldn't go there.
This is a morning session, Andre.
And I just woke up, you mean? Okay. No, they wanted to know my body size, okay? And I couldn't understand why they wanted that. But eventually I discovered that I was going to be put in a suit and look totally ridiculous as it was. But I arrived on the set itself, and I see that they're playing a scene that was the most difficult scene for me to write, because it's the moment in which Elio begins to hint at Oliver what it is that he's feeling. Mm. And he's not going to say anything, and they have the two guys arriving on a bike. They step, they go to the store, they buy cigarettes, there's a bus that comes in, of course. The bus is an extra. There's an old lady that comes out of the bus, and she's holding her shopping. There's a kid, et cetera, et cetera. All this is happening, and then the two boys start speaking, and the camera sort of shoots up and down, and the director says, cut. And I said, wow, this was perfect. This is exactly how I imagined it. No, it's terrible. Do it again. Same thing. The two guys come in a bicycle. They buy the cigarettes. The bus comes. The lady comes out. Anyway, so they did it about four times. And each time, the director would interrupt and say, no, cut. And each time, it was different every single time. They did it about four times. But each one was perfect. And I would never, because of the kind of person I am, I would never have been able to decide which they had to choose. Because they did it differently every single time. It's like having four drafts of the same chapter, and each one is, in this case, better than the other.
Did you have anything to add?
Yeah, I mean, I was actually on the set of all five of the movies. I was actually cast as an actor in all five of them, and the two of them, Filth and Ecstasy, they cut me apart out, basically, which I was kind of quite miffed about. But, and
you should have had a veto power.
Well, I think the interesting thing is, I mean, it's like a director, like, you know, I think directors like to get an author involved so that they can't really slag off the film afterwards. You know, if you're part of the film, if you're like, so, I mean, I've been an actor in five of them. I've been a screenwriter on one of them, and I've been a producer on two of them. So, no, three of them, actually. You can't really... They've kind of bought your silence, in a way. You know, so you have to kind of go along with the collective. You can't be kind of obnoxious and say, oh, they've messed up my beautiful book. You know, you can't see it like that. But I think that any kind of adaptation is... It's a win-win for a writer, really. I mean, your book is still there. It's not changed in any way at all. All you have is a promo film for the book that a lot of people will see. Or very few people will see. Or my friend John Baird, who was the director of Filth, he almost describes the book as a big fat leaflet for his film. Like, you know, so it kind of cuts both ways. But if it's a terrible film, you can go, oh my God, they fucked up my beautiful book. Nothing to do with me. If it's a fantastic film, you can say, well, they had this amazing source material. They couldn't really go wrong. So you have to kind of see it. And so it's win-win, really, I think.
That is a wonderful line. I'm going to steal it from you from now on.
But that is, you know, when Mistress came out, and many people who loved the book were lukewarm about the film, you know. And I remember I was looking up, you know, New York Times gave it a review, and they said, oh, this is like chocolat, but what if Juliet, in chocolat, Juliet Binoche says the chocolates became angry with her. And so were you able to do what he was talking about as to distance yourself from Mistress of Spices, the movie, and Mistress of Spices, the book?
Yes. And I was really very blessed because early in the process, I had friends who had gone through, who had had books made into movies, and they told me, you know, just spare yourself a lot of mental anguish. Just remember the book is always yours. The movie is someone else's. And, you know, at best, it will promote the book. At worst, people will say the book is better. So you know, it's kind of a win-win situation. And that's how I felt with when Sister of My Heart was made into a Tamil TV serial.
By Suhasini Maniratnam.
Suhasini Maniratnam, who's a wonderful director. And I have to point out the difference between movies and, you know, serials, because now some of my books are being made into serials. And I think the serial form lends itself some much more to being like the book. So I was very happy with the Tamil production of Sister of My Heart. And we did a lot of talking back and forth. And I felt she was able to keep to the spirit.
Well, we mentioned, and probably Vikram Chandra, who is not here, might well agree that perhaps the delay which ensured that Sacred Games became a Netflix series as opposed to a Bollywood film might have been good for a book the size of Sacred Games and the complexity of Sacred Games.
I actually think that what cinematic adaptations work when the source material lends itself to cinema. So it's not necessarily that you need more hours of cinema because your book is so many hundreds of pages long. The premise has to be cinematic, and I think the kind of mistake that they made with Life of Pi is they figured that A Boy in a Lifeboat with a Tiger was inherently cinematic. They mistook the visual for the narrative. A Boy in a Lifeboat with a Tiger is just an image, and at most is an anecdote. What is properly, I think, the source of the interest in Life of Pi is not so much that as everything that surrounds it. The fact there's an alternate story, the fact there's an interrogation at the end of the novel between these investigators and Pi. The whole kind of mental rumination is, I think, what was part of the allure of the book. And to mistake the appeal of it in terms of cinema, in terms of the visuals, to think that the visuals guarantee a good movie, no, they had to work harder. So this summer, Life of Pi is going to be a play in England. It's opening in Sheffield, and they'll hope it'll move to London. And there I made sure that they say, listen, guys, the Tiger and the Lifeboat may be visually interesting, but don't think that that'll keep the story tense for 2 hours. It won't. You got to look elsewhere and use that as sort of a lure in, but the tension has to be elsewhere. So I think for a good adaptation, you have to have, you know, characters that speak, for example, obviously. You need tension between characters. Well, you don't have that in Life of Pi. You have a boy in a life, but with a tiger. Tiger doesn't speak. So already there, much of the appeal of a tense relationship fades because you can't use language.
And also, some things change from the book. You know, in the book, Richard Parker is more unknowable till the very end. In Life of Pi, there is an element of, because for the need for dramatic tension and arc, it's like it's trying to tame the tiger, you know, pats the tiger on the head.
Yeah, there's that mistake of anthropomorphizing the tiger. I recommend do not touch a tiger. It'll rip your arm off. They want to do that. Yeah, so he was trying to do that to create that tension.
But speak on the other side. Yeah, movies can't necessarily think in the way a book's character thinks. But on the other hand, Andre, in Call Me By Your Name, at the end when Ilyu is staring into the fireplace for a long time, it's incredibly moving to watch it in the movie. Is that something that's difficult in terms of writing? Is it an example of something a movie can do that sometimes is trickier in a book?
Oh, totally. In the film itself, you have a scene in which Ilio, the character, is 17 years old, has just been told by his former boyfriend that the boyfriend is getting married, and he's a bit brokenhearted, and he starts looking at the camera, which is really looking into a fireplace, and the camera is on his face as they're setting the table in shadows behind him. And you can see his mother and the maid putting the dishes on the table, blah, blah, blah. But they're not in trouble. And he's just staring at the camera. And he's doing nothing but staring. And occasionally he will sort of smirk. The smirk goes away. He might smile. The smile goes away. And then you see him tearing up. And then there's music in the background. It's Sufjan Stevens' song. And it goes on, and he starts tearing, but he's not actually weeping
right.
at all. And it goes on for about 4.5 minutes of staring. It has never been done in cinema's history. And, of course, at some point, as I like to say, the credits come up, and you're shaken by the very fact that the credits appear, because once you see the credits, it means this is the end of the movie, and nobody's moving from their seat. And they all watch the credits. How many of you sit and watch credits? I never do. I walk away. I go to the bathroom. Okay? You
There's
watch
a lot
the credits.
Of credit watchers, yeah.
Yeah, okay. I'm sorry. I love credits. Okay? but the point is that once you see the credits, you realize the film is over and you didn't expect it. Now, the reason why I brought this moment up is that most people who read the book, my book, always quote the last few sentences as a moment in which they wept, because it tears them up. And it's not a sad moment at all, but it's a poignant moment. And what happens is that have a poignant moment like that, but it cannot have a boy staring at a camera for 4.5 minutes. Books cannot do that. On the other hand, if you don't have a voiceover in a movie, you have to have a face do all the job of a voiceover. So, and I ended up telling the director, and I meant it very sincerely, after watching the film, that I thought the ending of the film was better than the ending of my book, because it riveted you to your seat. You couldn't move until this boy was called to the dining table. Nobody could. Everybody read the credits to the very end, when they tell you who the singers are, who's the musician, et cetera, where was the film made, et cetera, and you watch. Because you're really watching the face of Elio, the character. And so in a way, you if you're an author, you have to also commend the fact that cinema can do things that prose is totally incapable
of. Thank you for listening to Jeopardites, a podcast produced by Lonchora, in association with the Z Jeopardy Literature Festival.